Hey, Ben. You love to wear hats, don't you?
I tell you what, it's because I just haven't gotten a haircut in forever.
I'm going to get mine cut this week, I think.
You're looking good, man.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I have to say, I thought you did a fantastic job with Christy talking about neurofeedback and Neurogen. That was so fascinating.
It's great to meet her and get to know her. I've already referred her a couple patients. So
yeah. Yeah. One thing you said, and I hope everybody, if you guys go watch this video, one thing that Doc said that was super interesting is that he knows healers when he sees one, and Christy was a healer. And that really connected with me as I was watching that episode. Shout out to Christy. Thank you guys for doing that important episode. One, because I know they do a lot of work with veterans and PTSD and just really important stuff. So thank you guys for doing that. All right. We about ready to roll?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see here. We're going to get to some questions. We got a lot of questions that came in throughout the week, so we're going to keep moving here, guys. If you have a question for Doc, go ahead and put it in the comments. Instagram, I'm watching you guys too, so if you guys have a question for Doc, go ahead and put it in the comments over there, and I'll make sure it gets seen over here. All right, let's see. Start with a hormone question. I've read a few more things that mention that static dosing as opposed to cycling for HRT could lead to thickening of the uterus and thus possibly increased risk for uterine cancer down the road. What are your thoughts on this? I know that you talk a lot about both static dosing as well as cycling. So what's your thoughts on this?
You know, I really like to, it just depends on the age of the patient. You know, I'll kind of cycle it anyway. There's Izzy coming up on my thing here already. She doesn't realize this is the beginning of the show. No, you're not supposed to show up till later. But anyway, that's why if I do creams, I kind of do it 6 nights out of the week instead of 7. If you're still, before age 50 and you're still cycling, of course, we use, pulse therapy, where it depends that we use more estrogen in the first part of the cycle, more progesterone in the second part. But once, most of the patients are postmenopausal and they don't have periods, so we usually use 6 days a week. But really, to be honest with you, and it is true that if you have unopposed estrogen, which you can't do in a woman with a uterus, you have to have progesterone. So it's true that any form of estrogen could cause a little thickening of the endometrial lining because it brings it back to a more youthful stage. Sometimes with the fact that they start having periods again, that's not real common, but it can happen at first. So it's not to get alarmed by, but if it persists, we usually like to send you to your gynecologist for an ultrasound and just to make sure you don't have a polyp or, anything real thick. But it is true it can thicken up the endometrial lining. That's why we use progesterone to kind of counterbalance that and protect that endometrial lining. But a little bit of thickness is going to happen, just by nature, giving you natural hormones. So yeah, that can happen, but certainly if you balance it with progesterone, it's not going to, it'd be very rare to cause something like endometrial cancer. That is rare. It could happen with or without hormones. But that's why we also look at any kind of, postmenopausal bleeding seriously and get it checked out. So it is something to keep your ear about, but so static dosing, I don't mind it. If you use creams, I usually use it 6 nights a week instead of 7 for most women, earlier than 50, cycle it anyway. And, if you do everyday dosing or even do pellets, as long as you're on progesterone, it's very protective and rarely going to be a problem. But you always look out for them, though, because if you have any unexplained bleeding, it warrants a further investigation.
Great answer there. Great question, too. I love these kind of contextual hormone questions because, you know, these sort of things we can really only talk about in settings like this. And it seems to me like it's kind of a, you know, risk versus, you know, benefit analysis, like you said, but and while also keeping your note, like kind of, you know.
I think that the risk of not taking hormones are way greater than the risk of taking hormones. You know, the benefits of taking hormones for your bones, your heart, your brain, your vitality far outweigh the risk. But you still need to get your mammograms annually and pap smears. So, and checkups. So it's important.
Yeah, guys, smart hormone therapy. Make sure, you know, ask these thoughtful questions. These are very, very important. Don't just go on hormones kind of willy-nilly. It is complex. So thank you for that question and letting us talk about hormones in that way. I'm going to get this question up here. Came over email. What do you think of the Life Extension products waistline control with Meritrim and AMPK metabolic activator? What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, I use both those. I started somebody today on waistline control. If somebody has a preponderance of abdominal fat, those are two natural ways to kind of fight it. I think they both work. You know, it's not going to work overnight. They're not automatic appetite suppressants. They're both herbal. The waistline control, I think, is made out of Garcinia mangosteine, if I recall. And the AMPK is more, I think it comes derived from a couple of things. One of them is rose hips, I believe. But, and another Chinese herb, I forget the name of it. But so AMPK is really, it's a more broad spectrum, really longevity medicine too, or supplement. It increases SIRT1 and kind of in a way, you know, AMPK is an enzyme that's made in your body and you make less of it as you age. And you almost think of it almost kind of like a metformin type drug. You know, it prevents glycation. It really, I don't know that I would call it a metabolic switch, but it's kind of like a switch to in your body that kind of switches it to burning the fat stores versus putting the fat as storage. So that's kind of how that enzyme works. I mean, your body's got an incredible way of storing fat for when you may need it, and then utilizing it when you don't need it. Other ways to increase AMPK, which is what that herb does, is fast, exercise, and certainly metformin does it as well. You know, the AMPK metabolic activator doesn't cause the GI side effects that metformin can. But yeah, both those that are used to kind of target belly fat is the way I look at both those. They work in completely different ways. You know, the AMPK activator's a little more broad spectrum as far as some of the other longevity benefits. How I would describe those.
Is this an either or an and product? Could it be?
You could use both of them.
Okay. Yeah. Great question there around those two products. Thank you guys for putting that in there. I think I can answer this one pretty quickly. How can I purchase the methylene blue caps from you? Drops are too hard for my mom. Right now the capsules are not online yet, but we need to make that happen, and that's on me. But they're in all of our offices. So if you're close to any of the offices, they're in there and will be online soon, which is, by the way, performancemedicine.net/shop. If you guys want to check out some of the Dr. Rogers formulas. Okay, let's go on to, this is a general question, but a really, really good one because, you know, one of the reasons we have this show every week is to hopefully give you guys the tools you need to have better conversations with your doctor provider. You know, so in general, if someone were to say, hey, doc, I'm getting ready to see my primary care tomorrow, what blood work test should I make sure I get? Anything that you would say for this one?
Yeah, it depends on what your age is, for one thing. You know, most doctors are going to check a lipid panel, metabolic panel, CBC, sometimes a TSH for thyroid. You know, those are the main things. You really need a lot more than that, though, which is why I run the Cleveland Heart Panel, which has different inflammatory markers. I would definitely ask your physician for a CRP, HSCRP, to see what that important inflammatory index looks like. Very important for an advanced lipid panel, not just your cholesterol, HDL, LDL, but for, you know, an advanced lipid particle that has an ApoB and an LP little a. And you also should get, in addition to a CMP, a hemoglobin A1C, which is a average blood sugar. That's very important. You know, we carry it a lot further with the Cleveland with the insulin levels and C-peptides, which is a little more specific. You know, I like to look at cortisol levels. I like to look at a more of expanded thyroid panels, especially in women, with not only a TSH and a T4, but the free T3 is really where the money is on that one. Mm. And I like to check hormone levels, you know, the male and female hormone levels. I like to check vitamin levels, especially vitamin D. You should definitely ask for that one. Very important. B12, folate are important. Sometimes I'll do a little genetic testing, especially the MTHFR gene and the ApoE gene. But your doctor may not, you know, have that available or want to run them. But definitely those others, like the CRP, the vitamin D, the ApoB, at least the A1C and those type things. Yeah, most doctors don't run quite enough blood work, I think.
Yeah, it's a great question. One, because I think coming in equipped with you know what labs you're wanting is one of the better ways to take control of your health. So I really appreciate that question. And I'll ask you, Doc, would it be cool if like they went in and asked like, hey, do you guys run Quest Labs or LabCorp or something like that? Just to see if, you know, because I know Quest runs the Cleveland Heart. Might not be exactly like ours, but.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. Yeah. You know, ask for it.
All right. Yeah. Let's keep moving here. Vicky, I see your question. Thank you for putting that in there. Barbara, what's up? Great to see you. We're going to get to live questions here in just a second. So if you have a question, go ahead and put it in for Doc. This is a peptide question. What are your thoughts on peptides like GHKCU? First of all, what is this peptide?
You know, I love peptides. I take several myself, but that's the copper peptide. You know, that's a good peptide. Really, it's more for people think of it just for skin and, you know, increasing firmness, decreasing wrinkles and things like that. But it also has some longevity properties too, as well. If you inject it, you know, you can get the copper peptides and a lot of over the counter face creams, but certainly the injectables are going to work a lot better because they're systemic. But I have nothing against putting the creams on that have it in it, but I really like the injectables. I think they work a lot better, but when you're thinking skin and maybe for even promoting hair growth, the copper peptide is a really good one. Very good peptide.
All right. Thank you for that question. Came on Instagram. This is another question that came on Instagram. Speaking of which, if you're watching on Instagram, you can if you have a question, put in the comments. I'll be looking over there as well. I see Dr. Creech is in there. Dr. Creech, so good to see you. Let's get to this question real quick. My cardiac calcium score is 223. 55-year-old female. What are my best next steps? Is this a coronary calcium score?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's not an alarming score. You know, if you look at the percentiles, you're going to get a little bit alarmed, but really it just depends on your risk factors for heart disease. So I wouldn't freak out at that at all. You know, anything over a 400, I usually will refer for a cardiac stress test usually, especially if you have risk factors. But I mean, it just kind of, it raises your, you know, consciousness about, you do have some calcium plaque either inside or outside your coronary arteries. And sometimes, you know, you look at which ones are involved, and it's usually the LAD, the Widowmaker, the left anterior descending. And I think my score 10 years ago was zero. Last year it was 92, but it was all in my LAD, which is the worst one it can be in. But that's not an alarming score, really, but it does raise a flag. So if you have any other risk factors, I'd certainly think about getting a stress test. You know, if you have no symptoms like chest pain, shortness of breath, and you're not a diabetic, you're not smoking, you don't have hypertension, you don't have a really strong family history of heart attacks in your 50s, then I wouldn't freak out at all about it. You know, it's not a perfect test. If you are overly worried about it, you could certainly get a coronary angiogram score, which is a CT angiogram, where they do that same test, but they inject you with dye. It's a lot more accurate. The other thing you might want to do is get a carotid IMT test. We do those at the office a couple times a year. The folks from Atlanta come up and do that test, and that measures the thickness of your intimal media of your carotid artery. It's a really more of a corollary test to soft plaque than the calcium, because the calcium score just gives hard plaque, which usually doesn't go anywhere, but it can be related to soft plaque, which is the dangerous type that can form blood clots, break off, and cause a heart attack. But so the carotid IMT test is probably even a better test, because it closely correlates with your, even though you're measuring your carotid arteries, to what's going on with soft plaque in your coronary artery. So don't freak out, but you know, it raises a little bit of a question: what else do I need to do to prevent heart disease, which is a major killer of all people, especially Americans? But so you probably want to get on a baby aspirin, an 81 milligram aspirin every day. It also cuts your risk of colon cancer down. But make sure your blood pressure's good and your A1C is down. You don't smoke, you work out, you're not obese, and do all those other things you'd want to think about. But certainly if you have a lot of those risk factors and you are having any symptoms, you need to look further with a cardiologist.
Great question. I'm so thankful that they sent this in. I hope that gives some peace of mind, but also, you know, some things that you can start to do now, some things that can help. So thank you, Doc. Great answer there. All right, we're going to keep going here. This is kind of along the lines here. I'm just going to put this up for Margo, our PA over in the Fountain City office where I'm located right now. I had a patient today who brought outside labs, was told they were all normal, but they were not. If you look closer, many were not in optimal range. So she's recommending seeing a provider who understands the difference between lab normal and optimal healthy levels, especially if you're having any symptoms. I think this is something that all of us can learn from and, you know, take with you to your providers. Like, I want to see optimal. A lot of people will say you're fine when you're in that normal range. So another tool in your toolkit to take.
Great point. Yeah, you want optimal. You don't want normal. Normal could be bad. Normal can be making a D minus.
Yeah.
You want to make an A.
Yep.
So you do have to look at that and listen to the symptoms, you know. So.
Okay, we're going to keep going here. This is a, let's see here, where am I at? Wondering if you would please share your thoughts on flea/tick preventative for dogs. Which kind do you think is safer for both the dogs, oral, topical, or collar? and for the people they live with, especially if the dogs are around children. Izzy and Ike are making a question, which is so cool. What kind do you use for Izzy and Ike? What's your thoughts?
I'm not a vet, so I don't know much about that, but I'd say it'd be safer for the dog to use it, a collar topical, maybe safer for humans if they chewed one of those things up, which is what we do. I think the interceptor may be one they chew up. That may be for worms. I'm not sure, but that's a pretty good question, really, because some of those flea and tick medicines can be pretty toxic. I think I heard something last year. A patient was telling me their dog had died by using one of those new 3-month flea and tick oral medications, they thought. And I forget, it was made by Merck, but yeah, I mean, I would use the ones that say natural on it if possible.
Yeah.
And talk to your vet about it. Say, hey, I'm concerned about this. I have little kids.
Yeah.
And also for your dog, you know, again, I'm not a vet. I'm not an expert on that, but, anything you can do more along the more natural routes rather than some of the newer, more potent 3-month things, I think would be more dangerous to your dog. That's a great question. So express your concerns to your veterinarian and get some reassurance along those lines.
Great question there. You know, I think, you know, Izzy and Ike are on the show each week. So I do think it's interesting. Like, what are you doing with Izzy and Ike? I mean, they're a picture of good health. So I think whatever you're doing, it's working. Okay, we're going to keep going. If you guys have any questions for Doc, go ahead and put it in the comments. Heather, did we lose connection? Are we still up on Facebook? I see Heather lost us there for a second. I hope we're still on. I see we're over there on Instagram. Let us know if you guys can't see us or if there's a problem. I'm going to go to Ray here on YouTube. In two separate studies done by Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic, pendulum probiotics with Akkermansia lowered A1C by 6 points and blood sugar spikes by 33%. What is your opinion on their product? So it seems this is pendulum probiotics with Akkermansia.
That's the second person that's asked that question in the last month or so. I don't know much about the pendulum probiotics, but man, an A1C that gets lowered by 6 points is unbelievable. I don't know if that is 6 points or 0.6, but I can't imagine it lowering it by 6 points. That's unbelievable. But you know, I have to look into this a little more. You know, I haven't heard anything bad. And apparently it's a pretty good product, but man, that's impressive if that's a real deal with 6 points. But I'll look into that more and, you know, and see. It's just hard to believe that it can lower it by that much.
Ray, let us know if we're interpreting that question wrong. But keep us posted on that, because that is super, super amazing. Super cool if that's what's happening. We're going to go back over to, let's see here. I'm going to stay on YouTube with Frida. I'm type 2 on metformin, 1,000 milligrams daily. Readings at 6 a.m. in the mid-120s. Now it's 130s, 140s, so up. Check it at 8 before eating and gone up 20 points with no food. Why, and thoughts on Ozempic, I believe she corrected that. Ozempic and those other drugs. Okay, I hope I interpreted that right, yeah. Frida.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly, you know, metformin, you're only on 1,000 milligrams. The normal dose for a diabetic is 1,000 twice a day. But your readings are in the morning. So, you know, it's not too unusual for you to get a little boost early in the morning because of the Somogyi effect or dawn phenomena, where your cortisol, which kind of wakes you up, temporarily raises your blood sugar. So that's kind of normal. You know, I'd like to know more about it, like your A1C and hopefully you're using a continuous glucose monitor. And you can actually really correlate it a lot better to see what it's doing in the middle of the night, you know, after you eat. You know, it checks it every few minutes. So you're really going to get a lot more information on how much time you're outside the curve. But as far as, say, if you're getting readings up that high, you definitely need at least a freestyle Libre. And you probably need to pop your metformin up to 1,000 twice a day. I love Ozempic and Mounjaro, and you know, I just love them for diabetes, especially if you're a little bit overweight or a lot overweight. They work incredibly well, and they also protect your heart. There's new data coming out all the time about how cardioprotective it is, how it reverses non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, how protective of your kidneys it is. I had a patient here last week that has minimal change nephropathy, which is a form of kidney disease, with a lot of proteinuria, and the nephrologists are starting to use some of these medicines for protection on kidneys. So certainly we have Ozempic, Mounjaro. We even have a couple of orals that are really, they're working a little different way, a lot different way, with the way they control diabetes by getting the blood sugar from the blood and transferring it to the kidneys where you urinated out. Farxiga, and there's another one out. I don't know why I'm blanking on it, but those are also very good, very cardioprotective. Jardiance is the other one. So yeah, there's a lot of great stuff out there now. And certainly if you're anywhere overweight and you're diabetic, you should get on Ozempic unless you have a contraindication, which there's very few. So yeah, I really do like them.
Frieda, I hope that helps. One, because I know there's so many people in very similar scenarios. So I hope that helps a few of you here tonight. Thank you for that, Frieda, for putting that in there. Bianca is saying, I missed the intermittent fasting / cardio risk study. Please talk about it. So I think the way I want to ask this is, like, are you still going to be intermittent fasting?
Yeah, I am. Well, if you look, you know, there was a recent study that came out and said it, you know, that people that fasted had increased cardiac events. But really, if you look at the study, and Peter Attia, Dr. Attia, has a good explanation of that study. I love it when he really goes through these studies with a fine tooth comb. He's definitely a researcher and a brainiac. But if you look at that study, it's really kind of a bogus study. I think the ones that had cardiac events, number one, it wasn't a placebo-controlled double-blind study at all. It was a random study. And it had quite a few people in it, but, you know, it didn't ferret them out into different risk categories. And the ones that had the cardiac events were diabetic and obese, so they already had risk factors. So I don't put anything into that study at all. And again, I'm not saying intermittent fasting is for everybody. You know, there's certain people that don't do well in intermittent fasting, but it's certainly great for, you know, senescent cells, and it's just a good way to, I think, add, you know, to lose weight and to add that extra longevity benefit, along with calorie restriction and that type of thing. But yeah, that's a great, yeah, people were freaking out about that study, but Dr. Attia gives a way better explanation and goes in, you know, he spends an hour on it.
Yeah.
So go to his last post or podcast, and he'll explain all about it, why he doesn't take any stock in it. But I mean, intermittent fasting is not for everybody. A lot of times you go by how you do, your weight, how you feel, you know, what's happened with your visceral fat, that type of thing. But Yeah. So it was totally misleading. I think it was based on a poster somebody put up at some meeting. So it really doesn't have a lot of basis to it, I don't think.
Bianca, thank you for teeing us up on that. I love talking about kind of things that new studies that are coming out and, might cause concern. Sometimes, you know, there is cause for some concern. And sometimes
you can come up with an answer, whatever you want to answer you want on a study, you can find it. Really?
I love that. Yeah, Glenn, I see you over on LinkedIn. Thank you so much. I need to start doing that, over on LinkedIn with the hashtags. Thank you so much, Glenn. I think Glenn's, in the UK, which is so cool. We got, people in the UK watching. This is amazing. I appreciate you guys.
It's
so
really
much.
Cool. It's gotta be late in the UK though.
It has to be. Glenn, what
time? Must be a night owl. He must be a night owl. It's 2 a.m. there.
I'm going to put this up from Morgan because I love hey, Morgan. And I think this is emoji talk.
Hey, Morgan.
And I think it's a doctor pills and injections. I love it.
Morgan's a guy that looks great. I mean,
he looks amazing.
Always say, I don't like to say for his age because he's not that old, but he's really he's got that longevity thing going.
He looks amazing. Yeah. Morgan, thank you for being here, man. All right, let's go to it's another kind of study type question. Richard's asking, can you comment on this article last week around the Cleveland Clinic-led study discovers link between high levels of niacin, a common B vitamin, and heart disease? Should we stop multiple vitamins?
No. Again, I think that was another kind of bogus study. If you look at that study, and I think maybe Atiyah goes through that one as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at a study, you think, man, I should never take niacin, which we've always thought of as being cardioprotective because it lowers your LDL, raises your HDL, and, you know, which is very cardioprotective. But now they come out and say, well, you know, more people on niacin had a cardiac event. But if you tease it out again, It's another one of those examples of people trying to make vitamins look bad. So certainly I wouldn't change anything I'm doing based on that study at all. And I forget the specifics of it. You know, that one came out a couple months ago, I believe. It was really a biased study. You know, it wasn't a double placebo random trial. So I don't make much of that at all either. I really don't. And again, there's different forms of vitamin B as well. But look at that study with a fine tooth comb and look at the analysis of that study, including the one Dr. Atiyah did. So no, I certainly am not going to stop taking my B vitamins because of that. And again, they don't even tell you what form they were taking, you know?
Great question there, Richard. Thank you for, putting that in and letting us talk about it. I'm going to get to Glenn's question because Glenn is up. It's 11:39 in the UK. So thank you for staying up late with us. And I want to make sure we get to your question. Let's get here. My mother has breast cancer that was treated, but she had no CT scan. Turns out the breast cancer had spread to her liver, pancreas, and lungs. Treatment is metformin, mebendazole, simbasterin, and doxycycline plus curcumin and vitamins. What else should she be taking, please? Great question there. Man, I'll be thinking about your mom.
Yeah, that's a toughie. You know, certainly I like the metformin. I like all those things she's on. You know, another one you could add is CBD. If, you know, hopefully she had she got the cancer out. You know, it's certainly within the realm that she can come through this, but I would certainly look at other treatments. I would look at both. Again, I'm a person that would be doing both, you know, the traditional and the alternative. You know, I don't know whether she's had, you know, surgery or lumpectomy, if she's had radiation, chemo, You know, I'm not against that. I'm not big on radiation. Some chemos work pretty well for that as well, if you can tolerate it. But certainly it seems like you're going more the natural way. Another thing, I would be on a ketogenic diet for sure. I'd be considering 91 years old. Okay, I understand. IV vitamin C, I'll certainly be doing that along with a ketogenic diet. Look up the studies on mistletoe. Mm-hmm. There's some clinics that are doing mistletoe that's pretty beneficial. But I certainly understand at 91, you're not wanting to really get too toxic. But gosh, I would look at that diet real hard. You know, read the book, How to Starve Cancer. Mm. That's a pretty good book. But good luck to her. We'll certainly be thinking about her.
Glenn, keep us posted on your mom, man. We'll be thinking about her. And thank you for putting this question in. And thank you for that book recommendation, Doc, How to Starve Cancer. Because I know other people are going through things like Glenn's mom. So thank you for putting this in there, Glenn. Let's keep moving here. I'm going to try to get to as many as we can. Let's get to Vicky on Facebook. The question is, what do you recommend for a four-year-old that lives in a poor air quality environment that is prone to upper respiratory and bronchitis type issues? Are there any supplements or other treatments you can recommend? You know, obviously you're not a pediatrician, but, you know, how would you look at, one of your own this way?
Yeah. You know, first of all, use a good HEPA filter in your house. That's really important. And I would also look at the nutritional aspect of it and make sure that they may have nutritional problems, like with glutens, with dairy, and that type of thing. I don't know if their gut's like, but certainly, you know, babies that are breastfed do better. But I like honey. That's another thing I really like. For you can't give honey to anybody under 1 year old, but for a four-year-old, you could give them a little dose of local, non-filtered, unpasteurized honey every day, a little dose, like a tablespoon of it. They'd probably love it. It's good. And do that, but make sure they're on vitamin C, vitamin D, and then make sure they're you use a good filter. And it'd be interesting what kind of poor air quality. There's a lot of smog around in a big city or near a factory or that type thing. But there's a lot of other stuff you can do through your pediatrician as far as antihistamines and things like that. But for natural stuff, I love honey. I love goat milk. I love colostrum. I like probiotics. I always look at the gut and nutritional aspects of that as well as what you're breathing in. But yeah, gosh. And if you get the immunizations, spread them out. Yeah. You know, spread them out.
Vicky, thank you for that question. Let's see. I hope that helps a little bit. We're going to go to Lori's question. What is the best magnesium supplement? I love this question because magnesium is so confusing and we talk about it so much. So
there's nine different forms, and
yeah,
you know, my favorite is a combination of magnesium glycinate, malate, and threonate. That's in what's in my magnesium bottle that we came up with. But definitely, if I had to pick just one form, it'd be glycinate. But if you're constipated, mag citrate, there's mag succinate, mag oxide. But as far as, you know, what I think you need magnesium for is more brain health. And certainly those cross a blood brain barrier. And that'd be my favorite, is that combination with the three.
Lori, thank you for that question. Love talking about magnesium on this show. I hope that helps a little bit. We're going to go to, let's see where I'm at. I see Carter and Katie got the IV question. Thank you for guys for that. Let's go to Loretta. Is there a supplement recommended to take if thyroid levels are on the low end but within the normal range per labs? Great question, Loretta. You might need more information. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you want to see, if your antibodies are positive. But certainly zinc and selenium are two that I think about that are good. Believe it or not, for some people, cruciferous vegetables are not good for thyroid. So you need to look into that, maybe not taking them if you have a thyroid. I don't know if you have a goiter, what your levels look like, but certainly I go a lot by symptoms. So you may even need to take, a prescription medicine, a prescription natural thyroid supplement that's desiccated thyroid, like Armour or NP. I use those all the time in people that have a normal thyroid, just like Margo was talking about. If you're on the low end and you're cold, you're on a low temperature, cold hands and feet, you can't lose weight, your hair's thinning, your skin's dry, you're losing some of your lateral eyebrow, you're constipated, you have brain fog, you're sluggish, think about getting your doctor to prescribe a low dose of NP or Armour thyroid. You'll feel a lot better, because I like to suppress that TSH to one or less, a little bit less sometimes, and get the free T3 up in a good healthy range. But certainly if your antibodies are positive, you definitely need zinc and selenium. Those are good anyway.
Yeah.
Some people think you ought to have a little bit of iodine.
Loretta, if you want to dive a bit deeper, Robin Riddle didn't explain this episode on thyroid antibodies as well as Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Covers thyroid really in depth, as well as some of those natural treatments that Doc was just talking about. So if you search thyroid and performance medicine, it should come up over there on YouTube. I want to get this from Michael, one, because it's I think we've all been there. The question is, what's the main cause of afternoon crashes? And mine always comes after my afternoon coffee, and I don't get it. What's your thoughts on this? And one, you need to tell Michael a little bit about methylene blue, because I think that does solve it.
The most common cause of it is boredom. I'm kidding. No, it's maybe hypoglycemia. That'd be a good reason to stick a Freestyle Libre on the back of your arm for, a couple of weeks. I've done it, and you can certainly see if you're crashing with your sugar in the afternoon. Sometimes I think cortisol crashes out a little bit too, but it seems to be related to meals. And Ben, you may have ADD, because people that drink coffee and it makes them drowsy, they may have ADD. They get tired when they take a stimulant. So that's possible. It does the same thing to me.
Does it really?
Really. When I drink coffee in the afternoon, it makes me more tired for some reason. So maybe we both have a little component of ADD, but look at your blood sugars. One thing that I do that I think's really helped, anybody that works at my office will tell you this, right after I eat, I go on a walk. Seems to prevent that. It's good after any meal. Again, I eat two meals a day, lunch and dinner, and I try to take a short, sometimes a longer walk right after each of those. I think it helps you metabolize a little better, and it'll prevent a lot of that sluggishness. But don't eat dessert. Don't eat sugar. Sugar is the main cause of crashes, I think. So cut the dessert out if you're doing that. And don't overeat at lunch. Don't overeat ever. But and look at what you're eating. If you're eating a lot of carbs, be careful. Make sure you get plenty of good fats and protein. And, man, you're right. Methylene blue is great. Love methylene blue.
I think what I keep hearing from our team and you and is taking it around that 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. Kind of keeps you focused the rest of the day. Michael, I hope that helps, man. We've all been there. And the walking is a big deal. Walking right after has always helped me. Okay, let's keep going here. I want to make sure I get to as many as possible. Where am I at? Shoot, guys, I'm sorry. I see here. While I'm looking, I'm just going to put this up here from Melanie.
Thank you, Melanie.
Melanie, that's so sweet.
You're too kind. You're too kind, but thank you.
Okay, let's see where we're at. Danny is asking, how do you feel about taking hyaluronic acid for joint pain? I've heard it doesn't work taking it orally. What's your thoughts, Doc? Thank you, Danny. What's up?
Yeah, it's not real potent orally for sure. You know, hyaluronic acid is great for skin. It's good if you inject it into the joint. But, you know, it's not really potent orally for joint pain. Certainly, what I like for joint pain, if it's gone for a while, if you've got a little degeneration going or maybe even a small tear, is PRP. Mm. I love platelet-rich plasma injections. Jill, our PA that works in Bristol, who's worked ortho for 20 years, she injected both my knees and my shoulder, and it made a world of difference. And she just, I think Kelly, my daughter, she was skiing this winter and fell directly on her shoulder, which had been bothering her for a long time anyway. And I'm pretty sure, well, I know she tore her rotator cuff because Ernie looked at it under ultrasound and she had a small tear. Jill injected it with PRP and it really has helped it. Mm. You know, it doesn't work overnight, but certainly I like that better than hyaluronic acid or any of the things. But yeah, I agree. Orally, it doesn't seem to work that great for joints. Mm.
Danny, thank you for putting that in there. I hope that gets better, man. I know that's annoying. Joint pain is no fun. Roel's asking, Doctor, I heard on a podcast that infants/toddlers are having eczema problems. Have you heard anything about this? More than normal. Heard anything around this?
Yeah, it seems like they're getting more rashes. You know, they all have cradle cap, which is kind of a form of eczema. But yeah, a lot of it's allergy from the toxic world we live in. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, they get introduced to, you know, some milk that they may not be able to tolerate and things like that. They start breaking out. But just talking about the four-year-old that, you know, had all these allergies, we're seeing a lot of more allergy problems it with kids in general. I mean, I think by the time they're 18, over 50% of children have a chronic illness. Mm. And over half of them are obese. So dietary factors are certainly, I think, part of most of that. I really do. That gut microbiome is out of whack. So, yeah, I don't see a lot of kids, babies anymore in my practice, but I certainly hear the same thing. And maybe they're not spacing those immunizations out enough. I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not.
Let's get to Lori here. Regarding the thyroid question, did you say you like this to see TSH around 1?
Ideally, yeah. And normal is anywhere, I think, from 0.4 to 4.5, which is ridiculous. It's such a huge number. But, you know, a lot of times I'll go by your body temperature and some other factors, like your free T3. And I always look at ferritin levels and cortisol levels. They interact with it, and insulin levels. Mm. They all affect your thyroid function.
Thank you, Lori, for putting that in there. I want to get to Lisa here. Thank you, Lisa. Lisa always shares the broadcast. So since my critically high CK level, I've had nerve conduction test and EMG. Neurologist said a couple areas of concern were revealed. Scheduled for surgery April 19th for multiple muscle biopsies. Do you feel like my 23-hour fasting, eating 1 meal a day, which is dinner, would have caused all this? Seems that she has friends who swears I'm harming myself by fasting. What's your thoughts for this? Because I know Lisa's lost a lot of weight recently, and you know, she's having people around her talking to her around the fasting. What's your thoughts on this?
You know, I would prefer that you ate two meals really within 6 hours. I think you might feel even better. I doubt that caused it, to be honest with you, but, you know, something else is going on. You know, definitely look at your gut and see what's going on with that, especially if you're having any symptoms from gut dysfunction. You know, sometimes losing a lot of weight quick can cause hair loss and things like that. I don't, you know, you always think, did something like that turn on some autoimmune process in me? It's possible, because, you know, it may be a little stressful for your body. Mm. That's why I really prefer people that tell me they only eat one meal a day. I prefer they eat two.
Interesting. And so, Lisa just said,
Let us know what happens with that.
Lisa's saying her gut is horrible as well. So, you know, healing the gut, it kind of, you know, always needs to start there. So Lisa, keep us posted, please. Keep us posted with how you're doing. Karen is asking, I'm guilty of taking several vitamins you recommend, but also trust your opinion. Do you recommend any baseline or any periodic labs for magnesium, vitamin D and K, zinc, saffron, as well as B12? So it seems that she's taking a lot of vitamins. Does she need to keep up with these labs to see what's happening there?
You know, unless you're taking an overdose of them, not really. Of course, we always check vitamin D and vitamin B12 and a magnesium levels on there as well. You know, if you really want to get specific about magnesium, you almost need to do an RBC magnesium level rather than the serum magnesium that most people, including the Cleveland Heart folks, do. So if I'm really worried about your magnesium, then I'll check an RBC magnesium. But no, I mean, again, with the D, yes, you need to follow that. The B12 is just a routine test. If I'm really can't figure out what's going on with somebody, sometimes I'll do a general vitamin level. It checks vitamin A, C, K. It checks a ton of them. Magnesium, manganese, boron. So you can certainly dive into that. But and certainly I don't think you're overdoing it from the looks of it.
That's a great question. One, like, you know, when we're taking, you know, so many vitamins, should we be following what's happening with our levels? And obviously you want to, you know, check levels to see if they're working. I know you talk a lot about vitamin D and checking levels with that. Karen, thank you so much for putting that in there. I'm going to get to Sandy real quick. Sandy, so good to see you. I recently bought the methylene blue working 8 p.m. to 8 to 8. So, okay, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., I'm assuming. What would be the best time for me to take this, and what kind of benefits can I expect? So it seems she's working the night shift.
I'd probably take it in her case around maybe 6 o'clock in the evening.
Okay.
Don't take it before you go to bed, because it's kind of can stimulate you and prevent great sleep. But so you would take it almost the opposite time that somebody else would take it. But it benefits focus, energy, less UTIs. It's just better exercise tolerance, better breathing. You know, definitely the main thing is more energy, more energy and focus. And we treat a lot of people with long COVID for it. It really helps.
Thank you, Sandy, for putting this in there. Because one, we haven't talked about it with this sort of sleep schedule. So thank you. We're going to take this last question here, then we're going to call it an evening. We'll get any questions I miss, I'll make sure we get next week first thing. Free is asking, hubby's blood work, his HGB was 4.2 in 6 months, then it dropped to 13.3. Any ideas? And I hope I'm reading that right, Frida. Any thoughts on this, doc?
That's hemoglobin. That's your red blood cell count. That's not a big deal. I mean, that's not a big move, you know, to be honest with you. Certainly with anybody, especially a man, you want to make sure that you know, they're not losing blood anywhere, especially from their GI tract. So, you know, hopefully they're up to date on their colonoscopies. If there's any question, you can get 3 stool GWAC cards in your doctor's office and check a stool sample from 3 different days to make sure they don't, he doesn't have any occult blood in his stool. But that's not a major drop in my opinion. You know, again, your hemoglobin and hematocrit can move around a little bit depending on state of hydration. So if he's really hydrated, it may have dropped his hemoglobin number a little bit. So if you're dehydrated, it can raise it. Smoking can raise it. So that's not a freak out level at all, but it certainly warrants following, making sure he's not extra tired or losing, you know, losing any blood anywhere through his GI tract. And hopefully his, you know, his differential on his CBC is normal. He is not, okay.
Frieda, I hope that helps. Doc, thank you for that. Okay, perfect. Perfect. Lisa says we did phenomenal tonight. What do you guys think?
Lisa does?
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben always does a great job. He makes my job easier.
You nailed it. You nailed it. Bradley over on LinkedIn, thank you, man. Thank you for being with us tonight over there on LinkedIn. We do this show every single Tuesday, 7 to 8. We answer your health and wellness questions. Guys, y'all make this show amazing. Thank you for the thoughtful questions. Thank you for having this conversation with us. And thank you for doing it with us every single week. We love it. To all of our team that's with us tonight, I saw a lot of Margo was answering questions. Katie was answering questions. Carter, Montana's in there.
It's all teamwork, isn't it?
We love you guys. Thank you.
Here's Ike.
Here's Ike.
Here's Ike. He needs a bath. There he is.
Ike just turned 2 the other week.
He just turned 2.
He's 2.
And Izzy is 1. She turned 1 over right before Christmas. So,
Izzy, what's up, girl?
He's pretty calm right now.
Thank you, Sherry. My brother Steve's in the building. Love you, Steve. Thank you for being here. Shelby, thank you. Shelby met you today. That's cool.
Yeah, Shelby's cool. I really was impressed with Shelby today.
That's awesome. That's awesome, Shelby.
I told her I like Shelby cars, so we hit it off.
Thank you, Shelby. We certainly appreciate you. Carter, thank you. Carter, I don't believe you. It was a 9.2. It was a 9.2. It wasn't a 10. Dad got a 10. And Montana's right. Ike and Izzy are the stars of this show. People are starting to ask questions about what they're doing, you know, with their nutrition plan.
I know. I need to find out exactly what they're taking.
Pop, I love you, man. Thank you for doing this.
Love you, Ben. All right.
Guys, we're out of here. We'll see y'all next week. Tuesday, 7 p.m. We'll be back answering your questions. Brad, where are we at, man? Where's our outro? There we go. Don't go away.